And in one hand, they had some eggs painted on this hand, and in this hand, they had an inflatable carrot.
Easter required my mother to be the careful referee of the precise allocation of candy across three identical Easter baskets.
It's time for the Apple Seed, filled with stories for you and your family. I'm Sam Payne, your host, and it's such a pleasure for me to bring these stories into your home and into your heart. We've been doing this since 2013, and the truth is, with the world so full of tall tales and folk tales and fairy tales and personal and family tales, we never seem to run out of stories to tell. On each episode of The Appleseed, you can expect to hear performances from storytellers all over the country and beyond, telling all kinds of stories. Some of them you will have heard. In fact, some of them are sure to be old favorites. Others may be new to you now, but they'll become favorites as you listen. The stories are sometimes funny, sometimes fanciful, sometimes filled with magic, sometimes simply filled with the thoughts and feelings and experiences that everyone shares. And today, on a special episode of the show, we're going to bring you some things you're sure to love. We're going to bring you a story from Karen Golden about preparing a traditional dish for the Passover Seder, a process that brings to mind for Karen the ancient story of her heritage and a few bits of advice for living in the world. And you'll hear a story from Dolores Hydock about family memories associated with holidays like Easter and Thanksgiving and birthdays, and you'll be reminded of the fact that while some of the ways we celebrate can bring up comical memories, the celebration of holidays can also deepen and enrich our memories of the people with whom we celebrate. We're going to talk about gardens and springtime. We're going to talk about the hope of recovery from a bothersome foot injury, and even about an engineer who lent his skills not only to the building of space shuttles, but also to the preservation of a migratory bird refuge. It's going to be an hour full of stories we hope you love. But first, we thought we'd start out with something a little lighthearted. For nothing but fun, we thought we'd begin today with a story from Bill Lepp, who made his name as a storyteller, winning public tall tales contests. They mostly call them liars contests in West Virginia. And now Bill tells stories on stages all over the country, on television, on the radio, in books. And this story is about how Bill and his pal Skeeter got library cards and about how reading American literature threatened to get them in trouble for vandalism. And how it all plays out is a bit of an Easter time adventure. The story is called The Inflatable Easter Bunnies of Half Dollar, West Virginia. We're happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed. A lot of storytellers will tell you that when they were kids, they loved the library. They loved to read. They would read all the books in the library. Carmen Deedy is always talking about the library. But when I was a kid, I really didn't have much affection for the library or really for reading. I don't know. I was a really slow reader. I don't know if I had some sort of dysfunction that kept me from reading well, but I was a really slow reader, and so I didn't really enjoy reading. Now I like to read, but when I was a kid, I didn't. And so I didn't go to the library all that often. But when Skeeter and I were probably in about the eighth grade, we were sitting around one day, and it was February. It was getting on late February, and you know how February is. It's been winter for just too long. Winter has lost its allure. You know, you don't want to go sledding again. It's cold. It's miserable. You don't want to go have a snowball fight. You just want it to be spring. And it's close enough to spring that you can sort of see spring out there on the horizon, and you know it's going to get warmer, and then it's going to be summer, and you're going to have a great time. But spring is still just too far away to touch. And so Skeeter and I were looking for something to do one day, and we made the bold decision that we would go to the library. Now, we hadn't been there very often, but when we opened up the doors, the little old librarian sitting at the circulation desk went, which was a reaction. It was a reaction that people often had when Skeeter and I entered a room that contained rare antiquities or things of great value. She said, "I sure hope you boys didn't bring those little fishing poles with you." And this was an allusion to an understandable, I think, embarrassing but understandable mistake that Skeeter and I had made some years ago when we found out that they had microfish at the library. Turns out we had misunderstood, but you see. So Skeeter and I went and we filled out the form and we each got a library card. It was the first time we'd ever gotten a library card. And now
It opened up a whole new world to us that we had not really expected to be there. We found a brand new fascinating aspect to life. We could go and read, and books are such wonderful things, because what always cracks me up is that your parents will be very strict about what you can watch on television or what movies you can go see or what records you can listen to. But if you're reading a book, people think you're doing something that is going to make you a better person, and they don't know what's in that book. And there are things in books that your parents would never let you involve yourself with, but they think, well, it's a book, it must be important, let them read it. And that's what we discovered at the library. And one of the first series that we ever found ourselves introduced to was James Fenimore Cooper's Last Mohicans, the Leatherstocking series with Deerslayer and Last Mohicans, and I think there's three more of them. But we really loved those two books, Deerslayer and Last Mohicans. What we liked about them was, you know, we were in the eighth grade, so we thought we were tough and macho men, and we liked in those stories the relationship that Hawkeye had, Natty Bumppo had with Chingachgook and with the other friends that he had, and how they were loyal to one another and honorable to one another and always did the right thing. We really appreciated that, and we liked that code, and we sort of adopted that code for ourselves. Love those books. And then finally it got to be spring. Now I do have to tell you this though. When I was a senior in high school, they passed out a list of the 10 books that every senior should read before they go to college. I had read 2 of those books. And my mother came home from school one day. My mother was a teacher. She came home from school one day, and she had a list with her. My mother was adamantly against banning any book for any reason. And she was irate. She came home irate with a list that someone had handed her of the 10 books that should be banned from every school library. And I had read 8 of those books. So I felt like I was really getting somewhere in my life. But anyway, it finally got to be spring, and the first big sign of spring is Easter, and this was a year when there was an early Easter. And people started to decorate for Easter. I always love Easter decorations, because Christmas, they go wild, but Easter, there's really just 2 things. There's the eggs hanging from the leafless tree, and then in the 80s, there was the inflatable yard ornament. And these were not the same inflatable yard ornaments that we have today. Now, if you go to your local superstore and you get an inflatable yard ornament, it's made out of nylon. It's really big. It's got its own blower, so it kind of blows up and it sways back and forth. And you might have Scooby-Doo going down your chimney at Christmas, or some ghosts that pop out of a jack-o'-lantern for Halloween. And they have, they're illuminated. They have their own lights inside them, so they change colors, the yard ornaments do. And they have light sensors so that they come on only at night, so that they're beautiful at night. And in the day, they just sort of melt and lay across the ground. And you drive around town with your small children who see Santa Claus melt and smashed onto the ground, Frosty the Snowman, and you have to explain that they're not actually dead, and if we just come back later, Santa will be alive once it turns dark. And then they want to know, is Santa a vampire? And these questions that you just don't want to involve yourself with, never thought you'd be asked, but that's the yard ornament of today. But in the 80s, we didn't have that cutting-edge yard ornament technology yet. And so what you had was a vinyl or plastic yard ornament made out of the same material that a beach ball might be made out of. And they were melted together, so they had this seam that you could cut tomatoes with. I mean, you didn't want to run your hands along the edge of a yard ornament. And the big ones at Easter, of course, were these Easter bunnies. And people would have a dozen of these things in their yard. And they were purple and pink and pastel green. And they had a giant smile on their face. And in one hand, they had some eggs painted on this hand. And in this hand, they had an inflatable carrot. And what you did is you, just like a raft, you pulled out the valve and you blew it up. And then you stuck the valve back closed. And you put that yard ornament out in your lawn. And everybody would drive by and think how beautiful it was. But there were several problems associated with the inflatable yard bunnies. One was that there was no way to fasten them to the ground. They didn't come with like a tent stake or something. So if the wind blew, all your Easter bunnies would get blown down into the fence in the neighbor's yard. So people would take them and fasten them to trees with a little bit of binder's twine or something like that. And so the other thing that was associated with them was that people didn't think about the physics of this whole thing. Now, we know now that technology has advanced. We understand air pressure better. And I'm not going to get too heady with you here. I don't know if you know this, but I am not a physicist. So But I'll explain this the best I can. If you take a bunny inside your house and blow it up, and let me just make sure that you understand, I am talking about inflating a plastic bunny, not blowing up an actual rabbit. If you're going to blow up a rabbit, you should probably do it outside anyway. But you take your inflatable bunny into the house, you inflate it, and let's say it's 70 degrees inside your house. Well, you get that bunny blown up and the pressure's just right, and so you know as well as I do that the molecules inside that bunny are reacting to the 70 degree temperature, so they're moving at, you know, 70 degree PSI. And then you take that bunny outside and fasten it to a tree. Well, this is early spring, so at night the temperature plummets. And as the temperature plummets, the molecules inside those bunnies start to slow down and the pressure decreases inside the bunny. So if you drive around town in the morning, those bunnies have deflated, but they're still tied to the tree, so they're just sort of hanging over that rope. They look like they're starving to death. They look like victims of some horrible regime, but they still have that giant smile on their face and they're looking at that carrot thinking, if only I could get to that carrot, everything would be okay. And then during the day, the temperature soars. You know, it's early spring, so the temperature might get up to 80 during the day. So the molecules inside that bunny start going really fast, and the bunny starts to swell and to bloat, but he's still got that rope tied around him. So now it looks like he's being cut in half by some horrible device. And, you know, Skeeter and I felt terrible about that. And one thing that we had really liked about the Natty Bumppo series, where there's this great scene where they've captured his friend Major Hayward, and the Iroquois have captured him, and they were going to burn him at the stake. So they built a pyre underneath of him and tied him to the stake. And Natty Bumppo, Hawkeye, wants to rescue his friend, but he knows he can't go in there and fight that large army of Native Americans without getting himself killed. And so he can't save his friend. But he also doesn't want his friend to suffer by being burned alive at the stake. And so what Natty Bumppo does is he goes off in the woods and he takes his black powder rifle and he takes aim. And just as they light the fire, he shoots Major Hayward right in the head and saves him from this torment. And as eighth grade boys, Skeeter and I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And we both swore to each other, you know, if you're ever tied to a stake about to be burned, I'll kill you just like that. I'll do it for you. And, you know, we were ready for that to happen. By the time Skeeter and I were born, the major conflicts of the French and Indian War had already sort of played out. And nobody used black powder rifles anymore or flintlocks except to prolong deer season for one or two more weeks. So we couldn't really go and participate in these battles and do these honorable things for each other. But we did have BB guns. And when we saw those bunnies tied to those trees, we knew we couldn't free them, but we thought we could put them out of their misery. So one night, one Friday night, we drove around town and we put all of those bunnies out of their misery. Really, I think the bunnies were sort of relieved because you'd hit them right between the eyes and you could hear them go, they sort of relaxed. And in the morning, Skeeter and I were surprised to find out that people weren't lauding the perpetrators of this act as heroes, but were rather describing this whole situation as vandalism. And again, one of the things that we had learned from reading these books was a certain code of honor, and that code of honor required that people be humble and not boast. And so we had not taken credit for this activity, so nobody knew that it was us who had done this heroic act, and we thought it was best to keep it that way. But we did feel bad that people were upset. So that night, Saturday night, we went out with a roll of duct tape and we patched up all those bunnies and then we reinflated them. So that Sunday, the third day, when we awoke, all of the bunnies had risen. And what we discovered was that the people of Half Dollar West Virginia have absolutely no sense of humor for that sort of thing. And even though it was never proven, they took our BB guns away and we never saw them again. But I think what surprised us the most was they never took our library cards away. So we could still go and read, and we continued to reenact classic American literature as often as we could. Thank you.
inflatable Easter bunnies of Half Dollar West Virginia, recorded before a live audience and told for you by the inimitable tall tale teller Bill Lepp. Coming up, a story of making gefilte fish for Passover and a family story about how Dolores Hiduck came to know that her dad loved her mom. It's right after this on The Appleseed.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on a special episode of The Appleseed. Before the break, you heard a rollicking tale called The Inflatable Easter Bunnies of Half Dollar West Virginia, in which, borrowing a chapter from James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans, nearly gets Bill and his buddy Skeeter in trouble for vandalizing the ailing yard decorations in their hometown of Half Dollar. In a little bit, we'll share with you a story from Karen Golden about how the panorama of her heritage unfolds in the making of a traditional Passover dish, and a story from Dolores Hiduck about how the celebration of holidays taught her things about the love her family shared. But first, because we believe here at the Appleseed that the sharing of stories here on the show can be the spark that ignites memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people you love, we try to include in just about every episode a little thought, a little memory of our own. We call each of these little five-minute memories entries in the Radio Family Journal. Here's one brought on by Thoughts of Spring.
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it. On the Appleseed.
Springtime, maybe more than any other time of year, is a time filled with hope. It's a time filled with the message that even after the kind of death that comes with winter, there's a rebirth that happens. The world comes back to life, and it happens every year. This constant cycle of death and rebirth and the season always makes me think of the stories of people. Someone might find himself or herself in a difficult situation, an illness or financial setback or a loss in which it's difficult to see the light at the end of the tunnel. It looks like nothing will ever get better. Eternal winter. But then, like springtime creeping quietly in on winter and bringing the world back to life, things do change. Spring does come. It's an example so small that it's almost silly, but a few weeks ago, I developed a case of tendonitis in my left foot. I'd been walking and running in the mornings, and one morning I walked out my door with a lot of pain in my heel. And I furrowed my brow and walked it off, but the next day it hurt even more, and the next day even more than that. So, almost incapacitated, I made an appointment with my foot guy, an old friend from high school. He gave me some advice and a little lift to put in my shoe and told me that my foot would get better in a couple of weeks. Nice story, I thought. From where I was, my foot feeling like it was, I thought, there's no way. This is the rest of my life, limping along like a pirate. Well, things take their course, don't they? And now I feel silly for feeling so hopeless. Spring, in spite of it all, always comes again, even for my sore foot. Maybe because of these spring thoughts, I've been thinking of another human story of despair and then a rebirth of hope. It's the story of Bob Ebeling, a rocket fuel engineer who worked on the Space Shuttle Challenger in the 80s. Now, I, like the rest of the country, remember going to bed on that January night in 1986 before the winter's launch, filled with excitement to see the Space Shuttle begin its mission the next day. I remember waking up in happy anticipation, and then, of course, I remember watching Challenger take off, and I remember watching it disintegrate in a ball of fire, killing all seven crew members. I was in ninth grade. But while I was sleeping soundly the night before the launch, with dreams of watching the launch the next day, Bob Ebeling and some of his fellow engineers were desperately working to delay the launch. They foresaw the problems that would mean disaster for the shuttle. And they tried to convince superiors that the launch should be delayed. But in the end, politics and pressure drowned out the voices of Bob Ebeling and his colleagues, and Challenger launched to disastrous consequences. Bob Ebeling retired from his work on rockets not long after that, filled with guilt that in the end, even after assembling reams of data, he wasn't able to convince the powers that be to delay the launch. It was a dark winter for anyone who loves space exploration. It was a dark winter for me, a ninth grader who loved space stuff. But I can't imagine the darkness of that winter for Bob Ebeling. Spring, however, was coming. Bob turned his attention to another love, birds. An enormous bird refuge near his home was damaged by flooding, and Bob put his engineering skills to work and saved it with the help of an army of volunteers, which Bob organized. For 22 years, Bob continued to volunteer at the bird refuge, making the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge the gem of Bob's part of the state. President George H.W. Bush presented Bob with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Award in 1990. It was just one of many recognitions bestowed upon Bob during his long service. Driving away from the tragedy of the Challenger explosion, it might have been impossible for Bob to imagine a return to happy, useful, life-affirming service to something he loved. But as surely as spring overtakes and subdues winter, he did just that. There would be yet another kind of springtime for Bob Ebling. Even through his laudable service to the wildlife refuge, he had a hard time getting free of his feelings of guilt about the Challenger disaster. He couldn't shake the feeling that he ought to have been able somehow to have delayed the shuttle launch. It hung like a shadow over him even years later. And then, in 2016, as part of a story marking the 30th anniversary of the Challenger tragedy, National Public Radio interviewed Bob. And the story of Bob's courageous stand against the launch came to the surface in that story, as well as the feelings of guilt under which he continued to toil even 30 years later. And then, a sort of spring. Following the National Public Radio story, letters to Bob began to pour in, hundreds of them. They were letters of support for Bob, and while a lot of them were from average listeners moved by Bob's story, there were letters among them from engineers like Bob, and even letters from some of the people with whom Bob had worked on the Challenger, some of his superiors. And with their outpouring of support, a three-decade period of guilt that began at the January winter launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger came to an end in a springtime. Bob Ebling, in the glow of absolution brought on by those letters, passed away peacefully in March of 2016. A springtime, in the end, of rest from an old burden. Yeah. In the depth of a dark winter, it's sometimes hard to imagine that the sun might again warm us and that the earth might again be green. But we've seen more than a few springtimes that teach us, in a lesson the size of the whole planet, that after the seemingly incontrovertible death that seems to fill the world in winter, spring comes and life wins.
The Radio Family Journal of Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for that entry in the Radio Family Journal. We always hope that the stories we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people you love. And if that happens with the stories you hear today, we'd love to hear your story. Email us at theappleseed@byu.edu. Some of our favorite stories come from listeners like you. Stories from Karen Golden and Dolores Hydock coming up, but first, in just about every episode of the show, we like to have a conversation with a friend about a memory or thought that comes from the reading of a book, the watching of a movie, the hearing of a song, the making of a meal, or any one of the many ways that stories can become important to us. We talk with librarians and restaurateurs and DJs and even some of the storytellers you hear on the show. But today, for a special springtime conversation, I invited someone special into the studio, at least someone special to me. Great stories come into our lives in so many ways, through the great books that we bring into our homes and into our hearts, through the films that we see and love, and certainly through the tales that we tell around the kitchen table or around the living room or the campfire. Talking about all of the great ways in which stories get down into our lives is one of the things we love to do here on the Appleseed, and we love to do it with friends. I've got a friend in the studio with me. This is Suzanne Christensen, and Suzanne is my wife. Suzanne, it's great to have you with me.
I'm very happy to be here, Sam.
You know, one of the things that Suzanne and I love to do, it's one of the things we've always loved to do, is read books together. We're talking a little bit about a book about
gardens today, a book about growing things. Suzanne, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about a book called Down the Garden Path. It's by a British author named Beverly Nichols, and it's a book that you and I read with Leah, her daughter.
And this book is—it's really kind of a memoir, right? About a guy's experience, sort of coaxing this garden into full flower, right?
Yes, it is. I love gardens and I love books, but I think I really love books about gardens the very, very best. And I've always gardened. You know, I've worked for my mother and worked with my dad and worked with my grandparents and loved flowers and stuff. But when I was an adult, there was a time I was looking through my parents' bookshelves for something good to read, and I saw this book. I was attracted by its cover. You know, say you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover. And it's certainly true that we've all seen beloved books with really bad covers. But this one, this cover was so fascinating to me. It looked like one of those medieval hand-drawn maps, you know, where you can see all the tiny houses and all the tiny people and all the tiny trees. And this was I realized as I was looking at it, was a map, a hand-drawn map of a person's garden. And all it had, you know, the cherry orchard and the formal beds and the kitchen garden. And they were all individually drawn. And across the top, there's this banner that's held by these two kind of fat angels that says Down the Garden Path. So I read it and I just loved it. And I loved it enough that I got myself a copy and read it with you and Leah. And we all cried over, you know, there's a chapter about finding a grapevine in this massively overgrown garden of this house that he's purchased and kind of nursing it back to life and it bringing grapes. And why it has stayed important to me for a long time is that it's not a gardener's gardening book. It's a garden lover's gardening book. He doesn't know a lot when he starts out.
Yeah.
And he's looking at the garden and he's thinking about what he wants, the way he wants it to be. And one of the things that he wants are flowers in his garden, blooming in his garden in all the months of the year, flowers blooming in the snow. But that idea of sitting with the garden and thinking about it and thinking about what it is that you want, what is it that you like? Not what your grandmother did necessarily or what your mom did or what, but what is it that you want? And I found myself flooded with memories of gardens from my childhood. I was remembering the enormous wild yellow rosebush that grew next door at my grandpa's house. And I was remembering the smell of the yellow roses in the sun and that spicy smell that comes not just from the flowers, but from the leaves and from the rose hips. And I was remembering the apricot tree in my other grandma's garden that had a three-story treehouse in it and how you could sit in the treehouse and eat the apricots and how good they were. And I was remembering my children building fairy houses in the roots of big trees. And I just kept thinking, what is it that you want? What is it? You can have your garden be the way you want it. What is it that gives you joy? We had a huge apricot tree in our yard that we ended up cutting down because it was beginning to die. But we did it in such a way that we hoped it would come back.
Yeah.
And we've been nursing it for a couple of years. And this year, this spring, the branches that have come out of the trunk of that tree are covered with blossoms.
Yeah, it's incredible.
We're going to be able to harvest apricots because we looked at it and we said, what do we want?
It's a resurrection story.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, you know, this spring is a different spring than last spring was, you know. With the coming of spring of 2020, we were all just going home. 2021, spring of 2021, is a different springtime. What are some of your thoughts about the story of the coming of spring 2021?
I think I keep thinking about the roses that I transplanted last year, that I moved from various parts of the garden. There were white ones and there were deep pink ones and yellow ones and pale pink ones. And I dug them up and I tried to be just as careful with them as I could be. And as it started to get a little bit warmer, I've just been hoping against hope that they'd be okay. And I've gone out, and there's a way you can tell if a plant is alive. You hold it in your hands, and you feel for flexibility in it, and you look for these tiny little swellings of this kind of flush of green, almost a kind of green that you have to just see out of the corner of your eye as the sap rises, and it's there, you know, they're all alive, they all made it through the winter. They all made it through being moved and kind of manhandled. And you know what else? There was a bucket full of them, cuttings from a rose bush that I forgot about. And all they had was some water. And they must have been frozen solid for much of the winter. They were just sort of cast aside. And I found them this spring just because I was looking for a bucket. I couldn't figure out what happened to all my buckets. And here's this bucket with these rose cuttings. And I thought, oh, shoot. And you know what? They're alive. Hmm. They're alive. So yeah, I mean, I am filled with a great deal of hope about the ability of living things to come back and to hold on and to take root and for the sap to rise and the green to come back. Hmm.
You know, the book that started this conversation is this wonderful book by Beverly Nichols that we read together, Down the Garden Path. And great stories can come into our lives in so many ways. Great books are one of our favorite ways. It's been a pleasure for me to have Suzanne in the studio with me. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining.
Oh, it's been really nice to be here, Sam. Thank you.
A special springtime conversation about a great old gardening book and about the coming back to life of the world after a long winter. A pleasure for me to talk to my wife, Suzanne, about those things. I hope you enjoyed it, too. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with a story from the Los Angeles storyteller Karen Golden about how the panorama of her heritage unfolds in the making of a traditional Passover dish. And another story from the Alabama storyteller Dolores Hoddock, who will share with us a comic romp through the ways her family celebrated all kinds of holidays. It's a story that will have you laughing one minute, and then in the next, we'll leave you thoughtful about the ways that our love for one another makes itself known in the way we celebrate together. You won't want to miss a word. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's special episode of The Appleseed. Before the break, a conversation about gardens and the coming of spring. And at the top of the hour, a rollicking tale from the tall tale teller Bill Lepp about the inflatable Easter bunnies of Half Dollar. And up next, we've got a Passover story for you. It's the story of a food tradition told for you by the Los Angeles storyteller Karen Golden. Now, the making of food in this story is an opportunity for remembering the values of Karen's cultural heritage. It'll give you lots of opportunities to remember times of your own when making food was much more than just making food. Here's Karen Golden on The Appleseed.
One of my favorite foods in the world is gefilte fish, which are like fish meatballs. And one of my favorite days is the day of the Passover Seder, because that's the day I used to help my mom make gefilte fish. The first thing we did was drive to the fish market. My mom said to the man behind the counter, "I'll take one whitefish and two pike." The man wrapped the fish in white paper and tied them around with a brown string. I got to carry the fish home on my lap in the car. Boy, did they stink! When we got home, my mom put the fish on the counter, and I cut the brown string and unwrapped them. Then she put them in the sink and started to clean them. I really didn't like this part, when she scaled the fish and deboned them, so I helped her by taking out my grandmother's old iron grinder. I screwed the clamp onto the kitchen table and tested the handle. "All set, Mom!" She brought the fresh fillets to the grinder, and I turned the handle. "Mom, why do we make gefilte fish out of fish?" fish remind us of freedom, said my mom. These whitefish and pike came from the lakes and oceans of the world. They have always been free fish, swimming in great bodies of water. Remember last week when you cleaned your fishbowl and put your goldfish in the bathtub and they just swam in a little circle? Well, those fish didn't know about freedom. That's why we don't make gefilte fish out of goldfish. Next, my mom reached high into the cupboard and pulled out a box of matzo meal. She let me put my hands inside the box and take out two handfuls of the grainy stuff and put it into the ground fish. Mom, why do we add matzo meal to gefilte fish? Matzo meal comes from matzah, and matzah reminds us of slavery. A long time ago, when our people were slaves in Egypt, they crossed the desert into freedom, and they didn't have time to bake bread. So they made matzah, bread which didn't have a chance to rise. Not all people are free, even today. We add the matzo meal to the free fish to remind us of this. Then, my mom went to the refrigerator and took out two eggs. I got to crack them. One, two. Mom, why do we add eggs to gefilte fish? To remind us of birth. Eggs are the beginning of new life. Even when we have a really tough time, like the slaves did, we can begin anew, and we must remember that we have lots of new beginnings in life. My favorite job of all was finally here. I got to take out my grandmother's wooden chopping bowl and the chopper, which was a sickle-shaped knife on a handle. My mom put two pieces of carrots and two pieces of celery into the bowl, and I chopped. You have to do it in rhythm, or else it gets terribly boring. A chop, 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 chop. Mom, why do we add celery and carrots to gefilte fish? They remind us of growth. Every day you get a little taller and a little smarter. Someday you'll stop getting taller, but you still have to get a little smarter. Carrots and celery just keep growing until we eat them, and then they stop, and we keep growing. I mixed everything together, and my mom added a pinch of salt and a pinch of pepper. Why do we add these spices? Makes the gefilte fish taste better. And the salt and pepper remind us to add spice to our lives as well. All the arts, painting and dancing, your music lessons, and Dad's wonderful stories. Life would be very bland without art. When all the ingredients were in the bowl, I mixed them together and started forming the gefilte fish balls in my hands, about the size of golf balls. You don't want to make them too big or else they'll never get cooked. I started dropping them one by one into the boiling water. Ugh! Mom, why is there a fish head and fish tail in that water and a piece of onion? The head reminds us of good leadership. Moses was a good leader the way he led the people across the desert into freedom. And the tail reminds us to follow and support those leaders we respect. You can't have a good leader without a following of good people. And the onion? Well, that reminds us of the tears, of sadness, and also of joy. Our people have had much sadness along the way, but they have also had much joy. When all the gefilte fish balls were in the water, my mom closed the lid, and there was a terrible smell of cooking fish. Mom, why is there such a bad smell? The smell reminds me of my mama's kitchen. And she used to say the smell reminded her of her mama's kitchen. I guess the smell of gefilte fish is like an invisible thread which connects all our kitchens together. Last year, I made my first Passover Seder. I got up bright and early and went to the fish market. I said to the man behind the counter, "I'll take a whitefish and two pike." Just as he was wrapping them up, I felt a tap on my shoulder and I turned around. There was a woman standing there wearing a blue business suit and high heels. She said, "Excuse me, but why are you buying those big smelly fish?" "Honey, You don't need to spend your day in the kitchen toiling over the stove. You have better things to do. Why don't you save yourself the bother and buy gefilte fish in a jar? Here! She gave me 2 jars of gefilte fish, and I thought, you know, she's right. I don't need to spend my whole day in the kitchen. I'll go for a walk or something. Thanks, I said as the man behind the counter put my 2 jars into a bag. I came home, and it was only 9:30. I had the whole day in front of me. I thought about where I would walk or go to the gym. It took me 3 minutes to open the jars. But then I stopped. I didn't want to go to the gym. I wanted my day to be filled with something different, something I don't usually do, something meaningful. Passover couldn't possibly be the same without making gefilte fish. I didn't only want to eat the fish. I wanted to make the journey. I got this funny feeling in my arm, this strange longing to turn something. Maybe I am old-fashioned. So I went back to the fish market and I said to the man, I'll take 1 whitefish and 2 pike. He wrapped them in white paper and tied them with a brown string. When I got home, I cleaned those fish and thought about freedom. Unfortunately, I had never watched my mother debone the fish, so I put them into my grandmother's grinder with all the bones, and I turned the handle. I thought the bones would soften up, like in a can of salmon. They don't. When you make your gefilte fish, you've got to debone them first. Next, I added the matzo meal. And I thought about slavery. I even thought about how we enslave ourselves with our own thoughts. When I added the eggs, I thought about birth and all the new adventures which are there for me to discover. I cheated a little with the celery and carrots. I used my food processor. But I still thought about growth and the importance of getting a little smarter every day. When I added the spices, I thought about how much I love to go to the museum or a good movie. And when I saw the head and the tail of the fish in the boiling water, I thought about leaders, like my teachers and even presidents. And I thought about being a good follower by listening and showing my support. When I cut up the onion and added it to the pot, I cried a little. Tears of joy for making my first gefilte fish, and tears of sadness for those who still don't have religious freedom. I looked at all those golf ball-sized gefilte fish bobbing in the pot, and a few minutes later, my kitchen was filled with a fishy smell. I thought of my mother's kitchen and my grandmother's kitchen. And I realized my kitchen had joined the legacy of gefilte fish.
Karen Golden with gefilte fish here on the Appleseed. In that story, the making of food is much more than simply the making of food. It's loaded with memories and even lessons. Alabama storyteller Dolores Hydock knows what it means for holiday celebrations to be loaded with much more than simply the celebrations themselves. Holidays are a wealth of shared experience with people, and in some cases, you learn just how important those people are to each other as you watch the way they celebrate together. This story is called A Birthday Gift, told for you by one of our favorites, Dolores Hydock. Happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed.
Birthdays were the only holiday my mother cared anything about. The rest of the holidays, she would have been just as happy to scratch off the calendar. As far as she was concerned, holidays were just a lot of headache and hassle. Christmas was the worst, of course, with all of its baking and buying and wrapping and shopping. She was never sentimental about Christmas. It was my dad who loved Christmas. My dad, every year, early in December, would head out into the wilds of the Boy Scout Christmas tree lot and with his bare hands select a 9-foot spruce. Strap it on top of the black and white Impala, drive it home, bring it into the living room, set it up triumphantly like it was some kind of a trophy he had won in the forest. Fed up with flimsy Christmas tree stands not equal to the task of supporting his trophy trees, one year he finally just made his own Christmas tree stand, welded one out of wrought iron. It had screws and spikes sticking into the middle. It looked like some kind of medieval torture device. There was a trough for wet sand that encircled the base of the tree. The thing must have weighed 200 pounds. And while there was never any danger that the tree would fall over, there was some concern that the living room floor might give way. My dad liked things sturdy, and he loved Christmas. But to my mother, Christmas was just a lot of work. The other holidays were nearly as bad, especially the summer holidays, because on each of the summer holidays, the major ones, Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day, my dad would cart the five of us out to Mineral Spring Park for a picnic at 5 a.m. 5 in the morning, when it was still dark. My dad hated crowds, hated having to fight for a parking space, hated having other people's noisy kids interfere with his day off. And so early in his career as a father, he came up with what seemed to him a perfect plan. We would have breakfast picnics. Up before dawn, three sleepy kids, one grumpy mother, and my enthusiastic dad would pile into the black and white Chevy, or in the early days, the pea soup green Hudson Hornet with the back seat the size of Rhode Island. We would drive out to Mineral Spring Park at the edge of town, where we would be, no surprise, the only people there. My dad would start a fire in one of the grills. My mother would set a picnic table with a red and white check cloth, plates and cups. We kids would go play in the woods. And then when the fire was hot, my dad would make breakfast, the only meal I ever saw him cook. Scrambled eggs with little pieces of bacon chopped up in it and home fries. Thick slices of potato fried up with onions and bacon grease. The best part, the crispy brown bits that had to be scraped from the bottom of the pan. By 9 a.m., when the other early bird picnickers were arriving, we were packing up to leave. Now that's the way to do it, my dad would say, immensely pleased with himself for having come up with such a perfect plan. Get the family fun requirement out of the way early enough to have plenty of day left to do something really useful. Build a 400-pound TV stand, maybe, or weld together a metal towel rack for the bathroom where it would leave four permanent circular indentations in the linoleum floor and would still be there in its original spot when they sold the house 43 years later. So, picnic over, we'd come home, my dad would start some project, we kids would go out and play, my mother would be left to clean up the mess. Two frying pans encrusted with burnt-on potato and a thick layer of charcoal soot on the bottoms, a tablecloth stained with Kool-Aid and jelly smears, and three sets of children's play clothes with grass stains on the seats. What was not to love about holidays? The week before Thanksgiving was inevitably the week that my dad would finally get around to painting some part of the house he'd been meaning to paint for months. He'd usually finish up the painting project around Tuesday of the holiday week, so that by the time all the company arrived for Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday, the house would still have that good, appetite-enhancing, fresh paint smell. To this day, the brand name that my mother most associates with Thanksgiving is not Butterball, but Sherwin-Williams. Easter required my mother to be the careful referee of the precise allocation of candy across three identical Easter baskets because my oldest sister would take her school ruler and measure the chocolate bunnies and count the jelly beans by color to make sure no one got any more than she did. My mother also had to navigate taking three girls shopping for Easter outfits, three girls who differed widely in size, shape, and state of adolescent irritation. But my mother got back at us for that, though, because every year, at least when we were still small, on the Saturday before Easter, the day before Easter, she would line us up on three chairs in the kitchen, drape us from neck to knee in long plastic capes, and administer the dreaded Tony Home Permanent. Overnight, the frizz would explode in the little poofs above each ear, so that the next morning, in spite of or maybe because of all the barrettes and hair ornaments we used to try to tame the frizzy poofs, we would arrive at church on Easter Sunday morning looking like a trio of French poodles in patent leather shoes. So holidays, my mother could have happily done without, but birthdays were just cake and celebration. And sometimes she would celebrate the whole week of a birthday, not just a single day. And so knowing how much my mother loved birthdays, my two sisters and I thought that we should do something really special for her 80th birthday. And we decided that we should all go to Paris. Paris, my mother said when we suggested it to her. I've never been to Paris. I'd like to ride that special Millennium Ferris wheel while it's still up. I don't think I'll be around for the next one. Well, that trip to Paris was unforgettable in so many ways, but the most unforgettable thing about it was not anything I ever expected. It was not the way the January sunlight filtered through the stained glass windows in Notre Dame Cathedral, or the taste of crusty French bread and café au lait in little left bank bistros, not even the astonishing view of the city from the top of that Millennium Ferris wheel. It was a gift that I got on that trip from the birthday girl, the gift of a story, a family story that was completely new to me. You know how it is. You imagine that you have heard every single possible family story at least 426 times over. But there we were, waiting in line to get into the Louvre, and Mother was chattering on, as she often did. I was looking around. I was only half listening, I confess. And suddenly I realized she was telling a story I'd never heard before. It was a story about my father and the day that he came home with a large pink cardboard box from Martin's, a downtown ladies' dress shop, a box that contained two dresses that fit her perfectly. They were for her to wear when they would go out dancing. I remembered those dresses. I would have been about six at the time. One of them was made of red taffeta. It had a scoop neck and tiny bows all over the full skirt that made a rustly sound when she'd turn. The other dress was sheer black organdy over black silk, and it shimmered like diamonds when she'd move. It had a wide black patent leather belt that she polished with Vaseline and she'd wear it with high-heeled, open-toed patent leather shoes. Sometimes she'd let me sit and watch as she got dressed up to go out dancing with my dad. I'd sit there on her bed, the chenille bedspread carving swirly patterns in the backs of my legs. She'd finish off with a dab of Chanel No. 5 behind each ear, and sometimes a dab for me too. And though I didn't really like the smell of it, I loved feeling elegant and grown up, and I didn't care if my sisters held their noses when I walked by. They were just jealous. And I would go to sleep those nights dreaming of swishy dresses and red lipsticky kisses and the clickety-click sound of high-heeled shoes on the stairs. And so I remembered those dresses. But until that special birthday trip, I never knew that my father had bought them for her, that my father had walked into a downtown ladies' dress shop and picked out those dresses, and they fit her perfectly, and she liked them. My father was a toolmaker. I'd seen his short, strong hands do lots of things. I'd seen his hands wield a blowtorch as he scraped paint off the front porch, or pick black walnuts from trees that grew wild down by the train yards, or put chains on the tires of the black and white Chevy on snowy Sunday mornings. I'd seen my father's hands do all those things, but I had never seen my father's hands encircled around her waist or caressing her face. They were old-fashioned parents. You didn't do things like that in front of the children. But those dresses were beautiful dresses, and they fit her perfectly. And I had never thought before about my father knowing the curve of my mother's body or the way that red taffeta would make her eyes shine. I never knew any of that until that special birthday trip. We got into the Louvre, spent hours in that museum looking at breathtakingly beautiful images, Monet's, Renoir's, the Mona Lisa herself. But the image, the breathtakingly beautiful image that will stay with me forever from that trip is the picture of a handsome young man in a brown felt fedora handing his wife a large pink box that contained not just dresses, but an invitation to dance, to music, just the two of them could hear.
Dolores Hajduk, with a story by turns hilarious and heartfelt. It's a story that might have you thinking of the way important people in your circle show their love for one another in the way they celebrate together. It's got me filled with thoughts and memories of the people that I love. In this special time, whether you celebrate Easter or Passover, whether you're a winter person who hates to see the encroachment of spring on the season you love, or a spring person who has been waiting for the world to come to life again, we hope the stories we brought you today have brought to your mind memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. You can find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed. For more full hour-long episodes of the show, as well as mini-episodes called Extras, usually just a single story, just a few minutes long, in case you only have a few minutes and you want to spend those few minutes with a great story, something perfect to listen to from the door to the store, say. Our producer is Jeff Simpson. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. I'm Sam Payne. I can't wait to join you again on The Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.